You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the Relationship Engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio. Welcome to 90 Day Soulmate with Lisette
and Jim.
Today we're talking about a very special subject. It is called Rescue Regret. What does that mean? Rescue Regret.
You told me.
Well, it's the stages of codependency where we look at somebody who is dependent or maybe addicted or maybe having trouble in their life, and we think we can help them, and we love them so much, and we are also dependent because we're intricately tied to their addiction, problem, trouble, and because of that, we're, quote, codependent. We're also dependent, and part of the dependency is we're almost addicted to the relationship.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to talk about today, is how we go from rescuing, and why do we want to rescue somebody, to how do we end up potentially regretting where we are in that relationship, and what can we do from that?
Sometimes you're confused if it's love or is because you feel that you have to take care of somebody.
And it can be both. It can be we are programmed to love somebody when we are in that rescuing mode, because that's maybe how we grew up.
Yeah.
Programmed to believe that to be true, or not even programmed to believe, but programmed to feel that's true subconsciously in our unconscious mind. This type of relationship, it torments us, but at the same time we feel we're in love.
Yeah, it's identify love through this.
Last week we talked about the archetypes, Carl Jung and all the different various archetypes. There are just plenty of archetypes, meaning you can take a stereotype of a person in a way, and archetypes are defined characteristics that go around something, like we talked about the magician, the caregiver, the lover, different identities that have different qualities and traits associated. It doesn't mean that that's all that there is out there, but it kind of gives us a mold to put things in, a basket.
Yeah.
Here's a basket of traits and qualities that we can describe and discuss with each other. The other thing, I think we were talking about this, do we naturally have certain traits, personalities that kind of go hand in hand? Meaning, are these archetypes somewhat real in the way that the human being can become this or become that based upon the qualities that we are? You know, humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we end up being, quote, an archetype, or at least a combination that's identifiable, because once you have certain beliefs, then your biases are based upon those beliefs, your actions are based upon those beliefs, and you kind of are put in a group or a classification.
So, but you can have different archetype in yourself.
Sure, multiple.
Okay.
Yeah, you can be a caregiver and a creator, or a caregiver and innocent, or you can have qualities of different archetypes within yourself.
So, and I think you cannot label with one.
I don't think you can label with one.
Okay.
I think some people may live their life as one more than another.
Okay.
But I think we may act differently, and we may act as a different type of person through our persona.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe through our persona, how we interact with the setting we're in, that can change what archetype we are in that setting. So at work, we're this archetype.
Okay.
Or this collection. What we want to do today is talk about the archetypes of codependency. What are the ones that may have more generic traits, propensities? What are the ones that are more typically, and what we think could be more typical, falling into these patterns? I went backwards here. So there are three archetypes: the innocent, the creator, and the caregiver, that we believe may tend more towards being rescuers, or we're using rescuers interchangeably with codependent, that you are looking to rescue somebody. And the personality trait or the archetype we think fits more into the person who has the addiction or challenge that we're trying to help, we see more as an orphan by definition.
Yeah, so it makes sense that orphan need to be
orphan needs someone to take care of, and that's how they fit and act. Mm-hmm. So the innocent, if you remember from last week, if you don't, it's our number two archetype. Somebody who likes self-actualization, self-help book. They're always looking for the best in people. They're positive and they search for happiness. They see the good in everything and everyone, and they want to please others and be accepted. So being so positive and seeing the good in others, when they see somebody who's struggling, they feel that they must have some inherent good qualities, like we all do, and we want to help them, right? There's a lot of empathy. Mm-hmm. A lot of let me help, let me take my goodness and share my goodness, because we can share goodness and smiles with people.
Based upon the no, evaluate risk and this help.
Risk? That's another R we're not going to talk about, or we will talk about, but it's okay. Not in our list. Okay. But risk is another R. Risk. We don't potentially look at risk in relationships when we're getting in, possibly because we're not seeing that clearly at the beginning of a relationship. And everyone is, and I don't want to use the word lying, but everyone's persona at the beginning of a relationship is a little bit controlled.
It's a promotion.
Promotion time.
Time, yeah.
More so than others. So that was the innocent. The next we want to talk about, as far as somebody who likes to rescue others, would be the creator. The creator looking for freedom because they love novelty, they love things new. But the main thing is they love to transform things into completely new. So they look at something that maybe a person, a relationship, somebody who's having a hard time, and they're going, you know what, I can help them live a new life, a better life. They have this cleverness. They are self-sufficient. They can also be very attractive maybe to the person who's down and out, because here's somebody who's so vivacious and
maybe feel more power because can
the creator
make, yeah, the creator,
sure, they could feel more power because now here's somebody that they can create for and help them, you know. Mm-hmm. In other words, this person's almost like my muse in creativity. Let me try that. The other aspect that we talked about, that last one, which is being imaginative and good-humored, but can also be inconsistent and think or plan rather than do. They may have all the best intentions of helping somebody and trying to rescue them, and they may have all these thoughts about it. Number one, it's more difficult to achieve than you think it is. And number two, for the creative person, they may not really actually do it. They may only think about doing it because they're in their mind creating this perfect environment that's much more difficult to carry out in real life.
I
do have a friend who I would say fits right in that role, and he had a relationship. I remember years ago, he had a relationship with a young lady who also had a child, and she had a hard time in her young life where she was a single mom in a pretty not great area of town. And she was nice enough in the interaction with my friend that he thought he could, he felt like he could help her. And it was interesting because all of his friends would see this woman and she was always mean. She was always tough on people, and we just never understood what he saw in her. But he was such a loving and caring person, and he was a piano player. He still is a piano player, keyboardist, just, and very loving. So he's like a lover, creator. He had these wonderful ideas, and he tried to be part of her life, And one of the stories is we went to another friend's wedding, and at that wedding, the woman who was there with him got into a little bit of a fight when the flowers were tossed.
Oh.
And that was when all of us were like, don't you see how she is? She's actually fighting with another woman at this wedding, and you're missing all this. Because, again, he had this belief of being able to help. And this is part of being early on in a relationship, is maybe part of this is the lust or the other pieces of a relationship where you're not seeing clearly what's going on.
And she got the flowers.
She got the flowers, pushed someone else under a table to get them, but she got the flowers. They did not get married, I'll tell you that.
Tradition for flower and marriage.
No, it didn't happen. That was like one of the little steps to ending that relationship. So the flowers, you know, were not a good sign. They were not a good omen.
Okay.
On the other hand, when we talk about the archetypes of the rescuer, let's talk about the archetype of the person who's being rescued based upon the 12 Jungian archetypes. The orphan being the person who has the challenges, can be walking around with open wounds, feeling betrayed and disappointed, maybe from other family members, from other relationships, or in life in general, and has picked up habits of drinking or drugs or gambling or something that is a dependency. They're dependent on these things in order for them to keep going. Wants other people to take charge of their life and will feel upset if no one does. So they fit really well with a rescuer, because now someone's helping rescue them. They're, you know, picking them up off the island and putting them in their boat and driving them away. And the rescuer is feeling good because they help someone. And
it's a perfect soulmate.
The orphan's like, pick me up, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm never letting go.
Exactly.
Oh, wait, here's some drugs. I'll let you go. Let me get the drugs now. Let me get the alcohol. Oh, there's another woman. There's another man. You know, when we talk about addiction or dependency, it's not, we're not talking just drugs. We're talking about relationships. We're talking adrenaline. We're talking other things.
About cars.
No, not cars.
No cars. Okay.
Cars are okay.
Okay. It's all the show.
That's it. So the orphan also can get with other people who are orphans. So if it's maybe they're a little bit depressed about life in general, where they are, and they're hang out with other people who may feel that same way, and they kind of relish in being the orphan, the victim. They're very manipulative too. Manipulative.
Okay.
They can be how they were treated badly. And so sometimes I hear a story from a friend or somebody I know, and they say, I just lost my job, and they talk about how they were unfairly treated by the company and human resources. And they were told incorrectly about how many days they could take off. Then I remembered, well, weren't they, you know, let go 2 years prior? And they said, yeah. And then that was, my manager was really bad. And they start talking about how everybody was, they were the victim of all these different people. And it was never their fault. So it was pushing the blame on others, and making me feel, you know, I'm manipulating me to feel bad and sorry for them.
Yeah.
And I'm going, well, wait a minute, maybe there's, you know, the common thing to all of this is the person. And some, I know that none of us like to feel like we are the cause.
Yeah.
What's next? So in codependent relationships, the person who is the rescuer could be involved with people of varying types. There was archetypes, you can make up archetypes, right? So there's an archetype for different things. And basically there is, it's a name that gives you characteristics of types. And so here are a number of archetypes of people who need to be rescued or would like to be rescued. The starving artist, the victim of maybe abuse, victim of an ex-boy or girlfriend, somebody who is a stoner, addict. They not only recreationally use drugs, but they do it to a point where they can't do other things in life. Slacker, they just want to hang out and collect money at home. They don't put in an effort. Con artist, right? They're always trying to cheat somebody. They tell you lies. A dealer, maybe a drug dealer, dealer of stolen items, who knows? A gambler. Oh, vampire.
What is that?
Vampire. A vampire. Well, it's not a real vampire, yes.
Yeah.
The vampire is somebody who drains you of your energy, drains you of your money, drains you of your love, maybe drains you of, you have a house where you live and they ask if they can come into your house and live with you, and you're like, okay, for a few days, and now 3 years later, they're still with you.
Like the Bob.
Like Bob over here. But at least Bob works the camera.
Okay, you know? Okay.
Good job, Bob. The person, these archetypes, these people who are need of rescue, they're typically users. They're unavailable emotionally. They feel like they're such victims that there's no way that you could understand how I feel, and I'm going to wallow in where I am. And by all means, they may have had a tough life and they may be a victim. But at the same time, that separation of feeling connected to others keeps them detached emotionally.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's very attractive in a way, like you feel like you can get through to them and I can help them and I'm the only one who can understand. So there's a challenge there, and then people want to rise up to the challenge maternally,
yeah,
or creatively, or even maybe a hero wants to be the hero and take care of all their problems.
Yeah, for feel power. Feel power is one archetype.
It is. The codependent person, on the other hand, the person who is the rescuer, may be excessively preoccupied with the people that they love, these people who need to be rescued, and they can't live without them. So there's so much effort that they're putting in, and they've built so much into this relationship that they just can't live without that person. When we come back on 90 Day Soulmate, we're going to be talking about the 5 stages of dependence and addiction.
Tired of attracting the wrong type of guy, it was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
90 Day Soulmate is brought to you by 90 Day Solutions. Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
Today we're talking about rescue regret. Mm-hmm. How a rescuer goes from feeling love and helping somebody to later on in the relationship feeling regret, and what maybe you can do about it. So the 5 stages of dependence for somebody involved maybe with drugs, alcohol, or an addictive behavior is trying something for the first time. You're not addicted. You could be addicted chemically before you even try something, of course. But for most people who end up being addicted to something, they start, you know, the first time, the experimentation. We all hear that, the experimentation. Then, okay, I've used it once, let me try it again. And they try it again. And then you hear they build up tolerance, whether that's alcohol or some other drug. They build up tolerance. They get dependent physically on it, that if they don't use it, they start to feel withdrawal. Physically, they don't feel good. And then at that point, there's the addiction where they need it, they want it. It's not like that they're getting the same feeling that they used to when they first took this thing, but they need it just to live, just to think, or they feel physically and mentally, they feel pain. If it's pulled away.
Dependency of the person or the relationship?
Well, this is the person who is addicted.
Okay.
But can we look at this in a relationship, that like I find somebody who is the orphan and I want to help them, and the first time I do it, mm-hmm. I feel really good. Mm-hmm. So I've now, quote, experimented with rescuing. Mm-hmm. Then there's a challenge in their life and they say, hey, can you help me? And I'm like, you know what, I'm going to help them again. And now I go, okay, this isn't so bad. Like, they needed me, I helped them, we had a loving moment, and we're together now. That then there's a, you know, the person calls them for help, and it's an effort, but it's not much of an effort. And this goes on where the person can become addicted to helping the person who's needing to be rescued. Now, they're not addicted to the alcohol, they're not addicted to the drug, but there's an addiction to rescuing somebody.
Okay,
so it's different. It's not a chemical addiction. It can be a mental addiction. It can be, if I don't do that, I feel there's something missing in my life. Mm-hmm. And the five steps to rescue dependency. Now, let's do this from another standpoint. You've probably seen this maybe online in a YouTube video or something, but it talks about dependency, and we've moved it to rescue dependency, where you are helping somebody and they show appreciation to you. So this is where somebody who is looking to be saved is becoming dependent on the rescuer. They then, once they are saved by you as the rescuer, they anticipate that you're going to help them again. And then you help them again, and the next time they get into this trouble or problem with whatever the addiction is, oh, I just cheated on my girlfriend, I drank too much again, I dropped out of work for a few days, whatever it is, they then expect for you to help them, because you did it again, there's the expectation that you will do it, because now you've built a pattern. Then they feel like you have to help me with this. Mm-hmm. You must help me with this, because they feel entitled to that help.
And
also,
maybe feel is it right for do that.
Right. Right. It's right. It's my right for you to help me. Mm-hmm. The other thing it can be is, you've helped me so many other times. The only reason I'm doing this again is because you got me out of it before, and you're enabling me to do this, and now it's your fault that I'm doing it, and they
manipulate.
Because
you're more strong than me.
You're more strong than me. You have to help me.
Yeah.
So entitlement. But you enabled me to do it, so it's now your fault. So now you become the reason that they have the addiction, is because you've helped them every time they've had a problem. So it's the manipulation that happens. Yeah. And then the dependency, this person who is addicted, they were addicted to something. Maybe it's out of relationship sex, maybe it's gambling, maybe it's alcohol or drugs. They're addicted here, but now they're addicted to you rescuing them too. And they can't get by without you helping them. And this is the codependency.
I can see also these behavior and maybe in simple stage when the couple doing stuff. So the other day I was in one company and I hear the VP manager and the wife, and he died, and he is part of the owner of the company, but the wife never do nothing about insurance and car and stuff. So she don't know nothing. So the company tried to put somebody to help her to review computer, email, and do the insurance. It's because she never, the husband, take care so much. Okay? So that is rescued dependency,
so
in some way.
Rescued so much that they can't survive on their own.
Yeah.
Which is something else. We feel bad for people, so we help them. Mm-hmm. And then, therefore, they become dependent on our help. And then they can't learn to take care of themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And having been involved with and knowing people who have been and are addicted and in addiction programs, you know that you can't help somebody who is not willing to help themselves. You can do an intervention. You can express how much you love them and how much you really care for them, and they really need to do something with this. And once they decide that, okay, I need to do something. And I know it's not easy to do, and it's, you know, when you have chemical dependency, you know, somebody may think, oh, they should be able to quit whenever they want. It is really, really difficult.
Yeah, it's not easy. And also more difficult is recognize that you have dependency, because maybe you believe, no, I don't know. And then how you evaluate yourself and figure out that you have some kind of dependency. Yeah,
that is true. So today's show is Rescue Regret. So let's talk about the four stages of the rescue regret process, where we go from rescuing someone to receiving a reward and feeling good about the rescue, to starting to resent maybe the person or relationship because of how you're not continuing to get that benefit, and then suddenly regretting that you did it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Should we go through that?
Yeah.
All right. So typically we're going to take this four stages and we're breaking this really into a relationship, a partnership, a two people who meet and they're falling in love. So we're going to go from that standpoint. This is not a family member to family member aspect. This is really a relationship. And based upon, like you said, not being able to judge the risk at the beginning of the relationship and going right into, oh, look at me, look at them, I can rescue them, and here, let's look at this. So the rescue stage typically happens during the lust or honeymoon stage of the relationship. There's wild desire to be with each other, the sex hormones, it's testosterone, estrogen are kicking in, and the true behaviors of each are kind of hidden. And manipulation takes place. So the orphan is manipulating the rescuer. The caregiver is being manipulated by the orphan. The other way around also, the caregiver may manipulate the orphan into that relationship as well. The prefrontal cortex shuts off, as we talked about in the past, in the lust portion of the relationship. And what we have found with codependency is there's an overwhelming feeling of empathy and caring for the person. The logical decision-making portion of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is not that it's not working, but it's not working as much as it would typically be. So a lot of codependency is built at this moment of the relationship. The reward that is gotten for this combining of, say, the orphan with the caregiver or the creator or the hero or the innocent, the reward is this attraction builds. Each of them is overcome with feelings. Neither can think. They only want to be with each other and they forget to eat or sleep. The neurotransmitters, like dopamine, is released in the reward center of the brain and it just feels great. It feels like we're winning a prize. Mm-hmm. Remember, like I told you, when I was competing for the relationship?
Yeah.
And it's just so emotional, and you feel like I was winning a prize. And I didn't know, was I being used by somebody? You know, if you say they're an addict, let's say I was trying to date somebody who just liked having relationships with other people. And at the beginning of the relationship, I'm trying to win them over.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel so good when I start winning, even if they're like periodically dating somebody, it's at the beginning, but I feel like I'm slowly getting them. It's great. Maybe it's not so great.
Yeah.
Because I'm not judging the risk. The norepinephrine, I always say that wrong. It's the adrenaline, the heart pumping, blush producing, sweat producing portion of our chemistry system kicks into gear. With the reward again of this in this stage is that all these chemicals are dumped into our body that make us feel great. So we've done the rescue, we're in the rescue piece, we're getting these rewards. What could go wrong?
We see.
I don't know if I can think about this. But now that I do think about it, the prefrontal cortex kicks in. Like we talk about after the lust and somewhere in the attraction stage before attachment, you start getting this, your logic starts coming back. You start thinking about long term. What's this relationship going to be like? It feels, when they are in their addiction, it feels like they're cheating on us. So that was one thing that I read about, which was when you are in love with somebody and their addiction takes precedence over you, it feels like they're cheating on you. And that's why it hurts you so much. That instead of being focused on the relationship, being focused on you, they're focused on this third party out there, you know, gambling. They're focused on alcohol or drugs. They're focused on, I like going out at night. We talked about when you first meet somebody and you're so excited, you go to the bar until 2 a.m. with them, and you're just excited to be with them, and now you're in a relationship, and you find out that it's not that they're going to the bar to every 2 a.m. to be with you, but they do it every night.
Yeah.
And now that becomes, you know, you're jealous there, and that becomes something that you start resenting them. So the resenting is, you're resenting the addiction, you're resenting them because of the addiction, you're resenting the behavior. We always say, don't resent people, resent the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, you know, it's tough to pull those two things apart.
Yeah.
So there's the resenting. Alcohol, drugs, danger, adrenaline. We talked about adrenaline junkies, yeah. Right? So somebody who just, you know, oh, I like racing my cars on the weekend. I jump out of airplanes with a parachute.
Yeah, on a motorcycle.
I cliff dive, or I go, yeah, I ride a motorcycle. That you have the adrenaline junkie, and you're like, they're more focused on getting that rush of adrenaline than being in the relationship with you. Part of this is, do you understand that? Do you accept that? Is that something that you want part of your relationship? But some of these things is that we think if they were in a relationship, they wouldn't have to do these things because the relationship would be all they need to enjoy life.
Yeah, but it's a balance, so you need to do a balance of things.
So after we go through all that, we start resenting the behavior. We may start regretting the relationship. How did we get here? How do we fix them? Can we fix them? We already tried. Didn't work. How do we get out of the relationship? How did I waste my time?
How did I
do this again?
The typical day that you figure out is, what are you?
Yeah, how did I get here?
Yeah.
And it's not a good thing. It's I just wasted
time. It's difficult. Yeah,
and then you think, I invested all this time, and I really did love the person. I still love them, but I resent them or their behavior. What direction do I go in? It's very tough, very difficult. Which brings us to the three boats. Now, let's go back in time, and now you're at the beginning of the relationship with anybody, and you don't know how that relationship's going to be. You're going to start to judge the risk of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And you have three boats. These are metaphors, analogies. These are examples of potential relationships, the type of relationships. And they are the speedboat, the fishing boat, and the luxury boat. The speedboat is this fast little boat that is flashy. It gets you around from place to place. It's really cool. You can go offshore for a minute or two, come back, and your friends can see you with this boat. And it's this flashy boat, flashy relationship. It's a lot of excitement.
Okay, but explain me more about how you relate this boat with the relationship.
Well, this is like you see somebody, you just you enjoy going out with them, you enjoy going to the club with them, you enjoy all these things that are these flashy, fast things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an exciting time. It's hugely exciting. You're doing it for the excitement of the relationship.
Okay.
And you really aren't thinking of the future. You're just thinking of how exciting this is.
At this moment.
And then the next is the fishing boat. The fishing boat is a type of relationship where it is, you know, it's a well-structured boat. There's not a lot of excitement. You can go do various things. In the meantime, there's work involved, right? There's work involved in the fishing boat. You actually have to think about where the fish are, where you're going. That it's
and have to work a little bit and
a little bit
and
of work.
Set up
and
the
we'll
boat.
Set up the boat, clean up the boat. There's stuff that you have to be involved in, and you go, okay, it's not as exciting. And I moved right into the yacht.
I like it there.
The yacht. It's a beautiful yacht. It's a big boat. Mm-hmm. On this boat is everything you can imagine. You don't have to do anything. But when you're in the boat, all your friends see you in the boat and like, oh my gosh, look at this. Look at this person's new relationship. Mm-hmm. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it amazing? It's majestic.
Yeah.
It's so
luxury.
It's, yeah. They have everything. And then all of our friends are jealous.
So maybe you act more for other versus, well, you can enjoy
you
yourself.
Could.
Yeah. But you don't have to clean or do anything.
You don't have to do anything. You don't have to lift a hand. All you have to do is
more,
be there.
More ice with my, my whiskey.
But when we come back, we're going to talk about the difference between a short little trip and a long trip in these types of boats and what that may mean.
We're here at Inglenook at Francis Ford Coppola's new winery. Well, they've had it for a few years. Let's take a look at one of the books in his library. Here we have 90 Day Soulmate, How to Find Your Perfect Match in 90 Days by Lizette Guevara and James Gulmick, actually Jim Gulmick.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
Today we're talking about rescue regret, codependency, and how you go from rescuing somebody much in love, much in wanting to do the best thing for that person, to eventually potentially regretting that relationship. We talked about three boats, the speedboat, the fishing boat, and the luxury boat, and the types of relationships those are. The flashy, so exciting relationship, everything is just amazing and wonderful. The one that you're working a little bit on, it's a little bit more daily maintenance. You have to know a lot about it. And then the other one, which is just the luxury boat, which is just beautiful, big boat. And it's you're showing off your relationship to all of your friends. So let's look at these types of relationships. What happens and what boat do you choose if you're going to go 3-hour trip along the coast or 3-month across the ocean? So a 3-hour trip might just be a short, safe trip. It's close to shore. You're able to show off to friends. You always have a life jacket that you're able to, like, you for any of those boats, you can do a 3-hour little trip. But maybe you don't want to show people you're on a fishing boat. Maybe you want to say, look at this flashy little boat I'm in. Or you want them to see you in the big luxury boat. But 3 months across the ocean, it's a long and treacherous trip. You're on board now with family and friends, and you're trapped with dependencies and addictions. Okay, what do we mean by that? Mm-hmm. So for all of these relationships, the flashy one, the one that's a little bit more work and you have to get your hands dirty, and the one which is the luxury liner, there's always family, friends, addictions, non-addictions. There's those things involved. And say you're on a boat, the luxury liner of a boat, because this person that you're in, let's pretend this person you're in a relationship is with a really wealthy family and they've got a really good job. However, you go on the boat cruise with them and their brother is a carpenter, but he just likes drilling holes in things, right? And the one of the parents screams all the time because they're abusive. Another one is alcoholic. Another is two of his ex-girlfriends are on the boat with you. And you say, here are all the things, but you get to show everybody you're in this beautiful boat and it's got a hole in the side. It's got a pyromaniac on board. It's got ex-girlfriends or boyfriends on board. It has the family who has addictions.
The crazy aunt.
It's got a casino on board, and your girlfriend or boyfriend is spending 2 hours every day playing at the casino, and you just sit there and you're not having the connection. Whereas on the fishing boat, maybe during the day you're involved with your
one
partner.
Interesting point is if you want to rescue somebody, you can find more people in the fancy boat versus the fishing boat, because the fishing boat is independent people. It's people that are working for on, they know what they're doing. So if you go to the other boat, you have to risk a lot of people. So, based upon they have a beautiful boat.
So if I show up in a fishing boat, mm-hmm. and then the person that I'm meeting, like say it's their first date, mm-hmm. and I show up in a fishing boat on our first date, they're like, oh my gosh, this is going to take some work. I'm going to have to get my hands dirty.
Mm-hmm.
I have to understand.
So people have more values.
I have to trust them because we're going to be doing things that may be a little bit dangerous, but we're going to do it together. Whereas, oh, here comes the fancy boat. I don't have to do anything. But at the same time, maybe there's other things. There's, what is it called? The hidden things that are involved in that relationship that you don't know. And so if you are the person coming to the relationship, should you come to the relationship in a speedboat, a fishing boat, or this big fancy boat? And I think the fishing boat represents being honest and open and assessing risk immediately in the relationship early on. And it may scare away people who want you to rescue them because they see it's going to be work.
Yeah.
And if you come in the big luxury boat, and if you are the one driving the luxury boat, they're like, oh, I can just hop on board and they're going to take care of me. Or the speedboat, they're going to drive real fast and do fun stuff. So, you know, it might be less about rescuing, but I'm just there for a good time. And then I'm off to another speedboat for a good time, then off to another speedboat for a good time. So presentation early on in a relationship and an understanding of what's involved, and that I'm not here to rescue you, I'm here to work with you to get to where we are going together,
mm-hmm.
building our life together.
Yeah, that's the point.
So we have a fishing boat, but it looks like a luxury boat.
Yes, because it's your view.
It's your view. Is that that it is, you can be on a fishing boat that looks like a luxury boat. You can be on a speedboat that looks like
a luxury boat.
But the point is one's either flashy, one's some work, but it can be what you want it to be and become what you want it to be. And then one is all the trappings, I guess that's the word, all the trappings of luxury could be all the problems that go along with it. And it's, again, an analogy that there's families, there's addictions, there are ex-girlfriends or boyfriends, there are gambling, there's all these things that go on. And there are, how do you get out of? And I guess that's what we're looking for next, which is how do you get out of? And let's look at what a codependent person, where their strengths are. I think that would be first. That, first of all, if we talk about somebody who's trying to fix other people's problems, they're trying to fix unfixable problems. We talk about the person who has to do the fixing typically is the person themselves. And if you enable them to get through and again and get through and again and get through, you can become addicted to each other in the inability to fix the unfixable things. That codependent people will put up with bad treatment from their partner. They will not communicate their own needs to their partner because maybe they're scared. They're scared for abuse from their partner, right?
Mm-hmm. Or they're scared also for confront, you know?
To confront, or that too. They don't communicate, hey, I need you to not do this anymore because they're afraid to confront. That's right. They feel shame. So codependent people feel shame in trying to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I know you're having a problem and you're wallowing here, but you know what? I'm going to go out. I'm going to eat healthy. I'm going to work out and I'm going to move to a nice apartment and you can just stay here. You know, no, I want to go with you.
Yes.
Let me go in your luxury liner. And the number five thing on this list of codependent people, they pretend everything's okay while the ship is sinking or while the boat is sinking. So that is the number one, it's the fifth one on our list, but it's the number one thing is that everything's okay even though the boat's going down. And that doesn't do anyone any good. It doesn't do the person that you're trying to rescue, and it doesn't do you any good. So this is the five steps for quitting, and this was a recommendation from Psychology Magazine on quitting an addiction, but we can also look at it as quitting, say, a codependent relationship. There's a lot of similarities between the person who is looking to do the rescuing and the addict, because there's a certain amount of addiction between the two of them. So first, if you're trying to quit an addiction, set a date. This is a recommendation. It's like, set a date for saying, okay, I've had enough, I need to do this. Put yourself in the right environment. So that means if you have got a gambling challenge, is no longer go to casinos, right? So, I mean, these are pretty upfront. Distract. You have to find other things to do. Then, like, you know, I like going to the same restaurant for dinner, but they also have a big bar and I'm an alcoholic. I have to try something else to do. I'm going to start cooking at home. I'm going to go actually take a cooking class and be very educated on how to cook, focus my time on buying stuff at the grocery store and making it at home rather than going to the place that has the bar. So, or just change habits. Reflect. So the reflect is, in the past, maybe you've given up for a while. Like, I've given up alcohol for a while. I've given up gambling for a while. When was I successful doing that? How was I successful doing it? So it's reflecting. It's almost like, it's like in our 90-day soulmate book, on when you reflect on old relationships. Okay. What were good relationships versus bad? What made a good relationship good versus... So it's observing past history to come up with things that worked for you. And then lastly, it's support, having a support network. So for like Alcoholics Anonymous, part of that is going on a regular basis, is being involved with others who are also having challenges and forming this team of support, this network of support, that if you're having a challenge, you're able to call somebody, and then you'll go meet at a diner for eggs or something, or coffee, and they'll support you and you support them through this. It's aligning yourself with a whole new environment. You know, so that's one of the big things, is that people want to change, but they don't want to change all the things that they're used to because, you know, oh, I don't want to do this anymore, but these are all my friends. I can't change my friends. Mm-hmm. Like, well, when you're with your friends, you do this behavior.
Yeah.
You know. So that was that. And the challenge with all of this is that it does take effort. You need help, you need support, you know, talk to if you're involved in this, talk to therapists, get professional help wherever possible. We're just trying to share information with you, and it's difficult to do a lot of this on your own. Why we're bringing this information is hopefully this is helping people who are not yet in a relationship, and before they go in, they can assess where they are. Are they a rescuer? And look at that, is, does that make sense? Should I really think of how I am and how someone else is? And when I'm in the beginning part of a relationship, really assess the risk. Try to keep that prefrontal cortex running. Try to keep the logic running. Try to realize that you're going to purposefully not see red flags early on in a relationship. Because when you don't see and ignore red flags early on in a relationship, you can actually addict yourself to a codependent relationship.
I can say my first relationship, when I was 17 or 19 years old, I know there was a little toxic relationship when I tried to risk my boyfriend and bring the old problem with the family, maybe like you said, the ball with the somebody alcoholic, somebody this, and then now that I have more than 19, mm-hmm. Okay, I see how different we see the picture. So my message is, you can grow up with this experience and have a better way to choose and change your behavior for be riskier person.
Okay, so we can change. One, we can recognize that we're doing that, and two, we can change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the third thing that I wanted to bring up is, and we brought up early on, is that a lot of times people who are the ones looking for being rescued are going to try to manipulate. And that will be done early on in a relationship. So that's where the number one thing is to recognize that if there is a manipulator, it's going to be early on in the relationship. Because as you learn more, it's going to be highly unlikely that you're going to be manipulated later in a relationship because you'll know enough. But unfortunately, you'll already be in the relationship, which then makes it tough to get out of.
Yeah, that is true.
So that's where we are today, is that we hope we discussed this rescue regret cycle, codependent behaviors, and potential ways to recognize that as well as recognize it before you get into that relationship. Appreciate you listening to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette
and Jim.
Have a great week.
Bye.
You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lizette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.